So today, usually we hold this kind of discourse in TCV school, Upper Dharamsala. But this time, when I have to travel back and forth, 20-30 minutes just pass by on the road, and I find it a waste of time. The most important thing is, I thought, if we could have the discourse here at Thekchen Choling Temple, then the local people also would be it would be easier for them to, and also elderly people, to gather here, to come. And then the students, for you to come over here, you won't have any problem. You can come here playing on the road and running and joyfully come here. So this is the reason why I have asked to have this discourse at the temple. And regarding the debate, it has been presented, I mean, going on since many years, the students also debate. This is something, kind of a new innovation. Not just, I mean, students don't have just have to study the different philosophies, I mean, philosophical views in their classes, but not only learning it in class, but what you have actually studied could be, after having heard the teachings, you need also to analyze the teaching. And in terms of that, in analysis and investigation, you may do, of course, verbal discussions, just normal discussions, but to be precise about what you are actually studying and what you need to reflect on, this kind of debate where you use syllogisms and reductio ad absurdum kind of logic is very useful and beneficial. And so we have this study of this and the Buddha Dharma through debate in the monastic institutions for centuries. But this, I thought that this should also be shared with the general public, so that they could also use it to study other subjects as well. So that this tradition doesn't remain only within the confines of the monastic institutions. And also in those monastic institutions where they didn't have, traditionally, they didn't have any study of philosophy and debate, I have encouraged the people in those institutions to start the debate and study of philosophy, and also with the nunneries as well. So this is an innovation that we have put in place in the nunneries as well. And then also in the schools. For the students, merely studying the normal subjects, like mathematics and so forth, may not have much to do with our internal development, mental transformation. Although the teachers may teach something and the students may listen to them, but through this kind of debate, what we are able to do when we study Buddhism is to understand the teachings better and more precisely, and you gain conviction in the teaching, and then also to transform one's mind, you could actually apply them the points that you have gained conviction in. And so in order to be slightly different in our approach to study the different subjects as well, so that you gain, the students could gain real conviction in what is what. And then we have also instituted this kind of debate, study of debate. And through the debate, what you actually are able to develop is the inferential valid cognition, and which actually gives you the conviction in the teachings. In the beginning of our exile life, the schools had this kind of study of debate, I mean, study of the philosophy, Buddhist philosophy through debate, but somehow this practice dwindled over the years and kind of vanished, disappeared from the schools. And then we have in the schools what we call Chöge, the religious instructor. But in the recent times, I've been saying that if you talk about just some somebody who teaches religion or instructs on religion, it could also this is also there in the others religious traditions like Christianity. Also, there are people who act as instructors to their people. But you, as there was this debate on the four schools of philosophy that you debated on, Buddhism, both so all these philosophical schools, of course, the philosophies of these schools were taught by the Buddha. But with regards to studying these philosophies through debate and reasoning, using logic and reasoning, it is, of course, taught by the Buddha, but basically, mainly, this became the part of the Nalanda tradition. And so I have been suggesting the people, concerned people in the administration of CTA and so forth, that perhaps we could change the name religious instructor to teacher of philosophy or instructor of philosophy. So using the term religious instructor could sometimes be quite ambiguous or problematic, and using the title philosophy teacher could be more effective, so that the students, of course, you do study philosophy through debate, which really helps in your understanding. And we as human beings have a very special brain, and this intellect and the intelligence that we have, with this we can actually investigate into how things are. So we could have lots of the thought processes going on, very active thoughts and ideas growing in our mind. So it's really helpful as humans that we could use this brain actively. And we have in Tibetan translation 100 plus volumes of the words of the Buddha and over 220 volumes of the exegetical texts written by Indian masters. So, of course, within the words of the Buddha, you don't find the use of technical use of syllogisms or perhaps the reductio ad absurdum logics, but explicitly, but the content of those are in there. And the Buddha himself has said, oh, monks and scholars, just as gold is tested by rubbing, cutting, and burning, likewise you should examine my teaching and then accept it. When teachings don't go against the... And so accordingly, and not because you have devotion in me. And so just as the Buddha himself has said so, what we need to do is to check his teachings and not take them with blind faith. So most of the other religious traditions in Buddhism, in the world, sorry, are not like that. So this is unique to Buddhism, where the Buddha has said that of all the religious founders of religious traditions, it is only the Buddha who has said that his students and disciples must check his teaching rather than taking them on blind faith. And therefore, we have Indian masters such as Dignaga and Dharmakirti and so forth who have written texts on logic and epistemology. And in India, classical India, masters have actually studied all these different texts on logic and reasoning and epistemology. So if you have, what we should do is we have these materials with us and we have to be able to use that. And for example, if you have a very good book on cooking and you just leave it on the shelf, it will not serve the purpose. So you should actually use that book and learn how to cook, prepare the different cuisines, and then it will serve its purpose. So likewise, it is the same with these different treatises to use. Otherwise, it's the text. Otherwise, they are a waste. It's a waste to leave it on the altar. And similarly, we have this our own language. These texts in our own language. Yes, Shulug. And so the Indian classical texts have been translated into Tibetan, whether they come from Pali or Sanskrit, and maybe also Chinese. We have these texts in our own language, and we can study the books in our own language. Not only that, regarding the books on epistemology and logic, collection of these texts written by Indian masters such as Dignaga, Dharmakirti, Shantarakshita, and so forth, are not even in Chinese, but only in Tibetan translation. So, by using a profound logic, we have this tradition of actually establishing and presenting the different contents of the different texts through logic. The profound logic is with us, and this is something we can actually show off to others. And we need also to use what we have, this treasure, or the... And another reason is that in Tibet, the snow land, since the times of the King Tisung Detsen, Master Padmasambhava, and Abba Shantarakshita, and so forth, we have the entire complete teaching of the Buddha, including this Pali Sanskrit tradition, Pali and Sanskrit tradition, comprising also the Tantra. And so we need to understand these texts and practice them. So this was lacking amongst the general public in Tibet, but mostly amongst the monastics, and more particularly the monks, and not even nuns. And amongst the nuns, those who have been through the monastic learning institutions in the learning centers, they actually pursue the study of these great treatises. And so we don't need to rely on other language. So we don't need to resort to another language. And we don't have to resort to another language and just begin the translation of these texts. We already have them in our own language. So whether it's the language, from the point of view of the language, or the Tibetan intellect, it is something that we can actually be proud of. So this needs to be known by the general public as well. But whether you become a religious practitioner or not, it's up to you. You have the choice. You whether you object to religion or not is up to you. You have the independence. Since we have, however, since we have this very good, I mean, an excellent teaching of the Buddhism, if we could actually make ourselves, I mean, equip ourselves with this knowledge and through understanding, not just by blind faith, but through understanding by using reason and logic, so this would be more effective. And rather than blind faith. And so, in order for the general public to pursue the study of Buddhism, as we say, there are 6 million Tibetans. If all the 6 million Tibetans could pursue the study of the Dharma, whether extensively or not, but we could actually feel proud of ourselves as followers of the Dharma, and it won't be like a hollow and something that is hollow inside but looks beautiful from outside. So do you agree with me? Or would you say, yes, but? I agree, but. So the children are saying they agree with His Holiness. And so if that is the case, so the purpose of your learning, the debate through logic is to this rich Buddhist heritage that we have, which is very, this pure tradition, I mean, if we could preserve it well, and it would be very good. And then we are in the modern times, so new 21st century, and which means there is lots of material development and progress through science and technology. And at such a time, today, sometimes it seems that there are people who only are focused on mere faith in their religion. But because of that, from amongst the younger generation, there is less less and less people who actually keep faith in their tradition, religious tradition. So I have friends who tell me these are happening. And so there is some problem. And therefore, if Buddhism were also to merely based on faith, then this could happen with us as well. But if you could actually study, understand Buddhism through logic and reasoning, then even from amongst the scientists who have no faith in the in religion as such, but they take interest in Buddhist philosophy. We are not talking about past and future lives or the Four Noble Truths and so forth, but they had gotten two truths, which basically talks about or refers to, shows us how things actually are, and then that there is also the apparent reality that appears to us. And so scientists take interest. So it's been over 30 years since I have had I have this discussions with scientists, and the world in general has become a world where there's lack of moral principles. And then even religion, which is meant for making better people, for happiness and so forth, there's a risk of these also becoming a tool for causing suffering to others, causing bloodshed. So we should know what is the relevance of the religious principles, how it is relevant to oneself as an individual, how it is relevant to one's family, community, the world at large. I mean, because of not having extensive study through logic and reasoning, I mean, people only could focus on Buddhist faith alone. So the fundamental or the essential message of the religious traditions is to serve others, altruism, whether it's Christianity or Islam and so forth. Of course, there are very good practitioners in all these religious traditions. We may not call them bodhisattvas as such, but there are people who are truly dedicated for the well-being of others. For example, Mother Teresa was one, and so everybody trusted her. And there are people from the Islamic tradition and also other traditions. So if you could practice sincerely these religions, whatever religion you are following, I mean, these religions can produce such good people. So with regard to Buddhism, what is required is not just belief in what you are told or taught, saying that, oh, this I must believe in this because the Lama said has taught me this, but you should have some degree of critical skepticism. So, and with that skepticism, you study what the philosophical views are in the different texts, the different philosophies, which use different reasons and logic, and how to actually face the challenges to hold on to one's own position. And through this kind of approach, then, you would be actually following what the Buddha said, just as testing the gold by burning, rubbing, and cutting. And so today, Tibetan Buddhism seems to be the only religious or spiritual tradition which is able to go hand in hand with science. So many scientists also say that they need to study and learn the different philosophical views and philosophical assertions in the text of that we have for this literature. And then also there is also the view that we need also to teach the moral principles in society. They are not religious people as such, but there are people who are social workers, and so they have such a view. And then, with regard to the teaching in Buddhism of about the fact that you need to have good heart, warm heart, but not just as some kind of a dogma, but why we need so should be understood, that it helps one's health, physical health, and also the society you live in, whereas all kinds of negative thoughts and emotions are not good for one's health and also the society. And so we need to actually understand the short-term and long-term goals of the moral principles. And what are the shortcomings or for the negative emotions and so forth. So through reason, we could come to some inferential cognition and understand things. And also like scientists research into things and they find something to be true and then they would accept according to their finding. And so it seems that we have the opportunity to contribute to the world at large from our own tradition and culture. I meet many people of different disciplines, backgrounds. So we see today in the world that how much bloodshed is caused because of our anger and hatred, and so people killing humans, it's very unfortunate. So many of the problems that we face today are our own human creation. And therefore, material development alone based on science is not enough. But what we need is how to overcome our negative emotions, destructive emotions. And that will not happen just through prayers to higher beings like God and so forth. What we need to do is all these negative emotions and thoughts, which actually destroy our peace of mind. We need to know the shortcomings of these negative emotions, and then we need also to know the positive effect of the positive emotions. So it is not that we talk about it, but even scientists find today through their experiment that the basic nature of human beings is compassionate. So I don't need to go through this in detail. So if the basic human nature is compassionate, then we have some hope. On the other hand, the contrary, if the basic human nature is negative, then we may not have any hope to change. Since basic human nature is compassionate, but we also have the other emotions such as jealousy, hatred, anger, and so forth. I mean, we must understand that since they come through causes and conditions, they could be changed, that we could make change and transformation within ourselves. So if we could make or create a peaceful or world of compassionate world, then this is what we should keep our hope in. So although there's so much focus on education, educating the mind, but not educating the heart, and when it comes to educating the heart, it seems people seem to think that they should rely on religion. But if that is the case, then of the 7 billion people, over a billion people have no faith. And so we need, moral ethics, promoting moral ethics, educating on it, if we have to do it on religious basis, then it will not cover the whole 7 billion, all 7 billion people. Therefore, what we need to resort to is education, to make people aware of these moral principles. So in religion, in the religions, we talk about hell, realm, and so forth. You, the students, are young now. Regarding me, I am an old man of 81, but I have many friends. I meet many people as well. And from these meetings and encounters, I could conclude that the culture that we have, I feel that I'm convinced that we can actually make a contribution to the world at large from our culture. So since this is what I see, I think that we need to be able to use this culture, the tradition that we have, properly and correctly. And so many of the elderly people, they are actually on the verge of saying goodbye, but you, the younger generation, are our hope. And I usually make this distinction between the people of the 20th century and the people of the 21st century. So me and my generation belong to the 20th century, and we are about to say goodbye. But when we, the 20th century people, have actually caused and created a lot of problems in the world. Lots of suffering is there. So since the basic human nature is compassionate, if we put effort, then there is a way to change and make transformation. And so the 21st century, generation of 21st century, we are now in the beginning of the 21st century, of course. And as time passes and we reach 2020, 2030, 2040, 2050, and so forth, which means you have lots of time now, the younger generation. So you should have a far-sighted vision. And put effort. We could see perhaps in the middle of the 21st century or the later part of the 21st century some difference and change. Maybe my generation may not be able to witness that, but in Europe, for example, the younger generation have a different thinking these days. I have listened to the BBC broadcast during the First and Second World Wars, especially the Second World War. Amongst the nations, peoples of the nations, there were this animosity amongst the people, regarding themselves as sworn enemies, but this has changed completely. And then during the First World War, hundreds of thousands of people were killed in Franco-German wars. But later on, the French president and the German chancellor met, and they came up with new ideas to change their perspective, outlook on the world. And so people are changing, and recently, according to BBC, many people in Europe are thinking of themselves as being global citizens. So not just thinking being a citizen of one country or another country, but a global citizen. So these seem to indicate that we are able to take the lessons from our past experiences, because we have gone through lots of hardships in the past. People are becoming aware that the method that we have been using so far to solve problems through weapons or arms is not right. And therefore, you should keep this in mind. As I said the other day during the Sikyong swearing-in ceremony, Tibet is known as the roof of the world, and from our from the point of view of our knowledge also, we could call we have the pinnacle of culture. So these will be used by you, the younger generation, and not me. I only I'm only someone who babbles about these. So you should not think only about your own livelihood, but nor should you think only about Tibetan people as such, but you should think about the world at large. And so I wish to say this especially to the students. So please pay attention to these. So through your education, especially through the study of philosophy, through logic and reasoning, will make you, widen your scope of thought. So regarding the teaching now, with regard to the teaching of the Buddha, Buddhism, of course, before Buddhism, there were many religious traditions already existing in the world, and especially in India, there were all these religious and spiritual traditions which have philosophical backgrounds, philosophical assertions, and it is said that Egyptian civilization is 4,000 to 5,000 years, and also similarly with Chinese civilization. And there may have been primitive religious traditions also in the past, but they don't have any philosophical assertions or views. But basically they were the worshipping, people may be worshipping just nature or gods and spirits, but most of the Indian spiritual traditions have some philosophical understanding and views and explanations. And before the Buddha came to India, there were these religious spiritual traditions with philosophical views. For example, Jainism came before Buddhism, and then Buddha Shakyamuni came later. The Buddha, when he became enlightened, this profound, peaceful, unfabricated dharma have I found, and it will not be understood by anyone if I were to teach it. Therefore, I keep silence in the forest. And so the Buddha says that I'm not going to teach what I have found, discovered, this profound, peaceful, and the principle with the thing which is without any fabrication, and which is clear light, and also uncomposed or uncompounded. And so these words are taught in the Tibetan traditions like Dzogchen or Kagyu, Mahamudra, and also Sakya tradition, which talks about the union of clarity and emptiness. And then in the Gelug tradition, there's this term the union of bliss and emptiness, all of these boil down to the same meaning, which is what the Buddha discovered at Substitute. So this nectar-like dharma have I found, the Buddha said. And so, of course, the reason why the Buddha said that if I were to teach this to others, nobody will understand it, and therefore I keep in silence in the forest. Because what he actually understood and he actually found and discovered fully is emptiness. And therefore, it is something which is difficult for ordinary people to understand. And so the teaching of the Buddha hinges on this understanding of selflessness. In those days when the Buddha lived, nobody would actually be able to take if he were to talk about selflessness. So because the whole region, the whole country here in India believed in the theory of Atman or some independent soul, and therefore nobody would be able to believe what the Buddha would have taught them. And therefore he didn't teach. But then later, as time went on, then the five human disciples of the Buddha, before they became his disciples, they were together with the Buddha as ascetics. They were also following the practice of asceticism. And then they actually revolted, turned their back to the Buddha and left him because of certain practices that the Buddha did. But finally, after becoming enlightened, the Buddha, saw the Buddha as the Buddha was coming towards them. They had no choice but to actually get up from their seat and respect the Buddha. And so the Buddha became a self-ordained, and then he had these five first human disciples who were his sangha, and then the Buddha gave the teaching at the request of the gods like Brahma, Indra, and so forth. So after the Buddha assumed the deed of becoming enlightened, even his demeanor, his physical expressions could actually appeal the general people, and therefore he gave the teaching of the teaching on the Four Noble Truths, where he said this is the truth of suffering, in the view of the Aryas, and this is the origin of suffering in the view of the Aryas, and so forth. And then during the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha taught that there is no substantially sufficiently existing self. And then there is no inherent existence, inherently existing self. So the reason why the Buddha taught selflessness is because things are dependently originated. it's not just saying that because if you were to search for a self, you will not find it. That's not the only reason, but because of dependent origination. So if you were to search for the self amongst the five psychophysical aggregates, you will not find anything that you can point to as being the self, because it is dependently, the self or the person is dependently arisen or dependently designated. And so on the basis of this understanding of dependent origination, the Four Noble Truths, teaching on the Four Noble Truths come. As you have already debated earlier, that you, if you cultivate good causes, then you will have happiness as the good result. And likewise, if from bad causes and conditions, you have bad results. We can see these things happening in our in the external world according to the different climate conditions. We can see things growing and then at some point they wither, and so like just as the law of causality works in the external world, likewise it works within ourselves in terms of our happiness and suffering. So if suffering and happiness do not have any causes and conditions that produce them, then we would have to say the logical conclusion would be that either we have suffering all the time and or happiness all the time, or we don't have any of them at all. And so on the basis of this and the teaching on the causality, law of causality, Buddha taught us that the suffering which we don't want has its cause, which is the origin of suffering. And since we want suffering, but not just the feeling of happiness, just a feeling is not that, but what the Buddha has said, that you should know suffering, what suffering constitutes, what are the different types of suffering, and so forth. And then you will actually go into looking for the cause of suffering. If you are able to stop that cause, then you will have lasting happiness, not just alleviating some degree of suffering or pain temporarily. And therefore, we come to the understanding of the not just the understanding of gross or coarse understanding of dependent origination, but the subtle understanding of dependent origination, which means that things are designated. And so in Kamala Shila's text and Chandrakshita's text, the Tattva Samgraha, and its commentary by Kamala Shila, and so Kamala Shila mentions in the Tattva Samgraha Panjika, which is the commentary on the Tattva Samgraha on the difficult points, he says that through based on the understanding of law of causality, we create the causes for higher rebirth, and based on the understanding of the dependent designation, which is the subtler dependence, see, we actually create the causes for liberation, definite goodness. So since we don't want suffering, but we want happiness, and since both of them come through causes and conditions, therefore the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, which mainly is based on the understanding of causality. And when it comes to understanding, when it comes to the point of understanding the true cessation, so the Buddha, what Buddha teaches is that the cause or the origin of suffering can be overcome. It's not just the cause here does not refer only to the attachment or anger, but a fundamental ignorance. which is a distorted view of reality. And whether we should, what we should see is whether it, there is an antidote or counterforce to it or not that can put an end to it. So, for example, if you are ignorant about the letters, the alphabet, what we need, to, what you need to do is not just to wish that, thinking, oh, if I wish I could know the alphabet, but you should actually learn what the alphabet is, and then through that knowledge of what alphabets, the knowledge of the alphabet, then you will be able to discard that ignorance about the alphabet. And so what we should first know what ignorance is here in this context of Dharma. So when you make very go into subtle distinctions of this, then ignorance, then there are different explanations, like those philosophic schools which only explain selflessness of persons and not selflessness of phenomena, whereas there are the other schools of philosophy, such as Cittamatra and Madhyamakas, which explain the both the selflessnesses. These texts that were written by Indian masters are not just to show off their creativity or anything like that, but we are actually thinking about the reality of how things are in order to make transformation with them. And so all these different philosophical assertions, philosophical views are to counter, in order for us to be able to counter our basic ignorance. And therefore the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, truth of suffering, true origin, true cessation, and true path. So having taught these four truths, four noble truths, I mean, how do we go about with discarding the negative things and adopting the positive ones? And so the Buddha said, you should know suffering and overcome the cause or the origin of suffering and actualize or experience cessation and cultivate the path. So with regard to knowing what suffering is, even animals and down to this insect, small crawling insects and creatures know there is suffering because they all work for themselves to overcome a certain degree of suffering. Now here when the Buddha said, know suffering, what you, as you already had debate on it, the three types of suffering, suffering of suffering, changeable suffering, and suffering of pervasive existential suffering. So what the Buddha is basically referring to is the third type of suffering. We need, for that, we need to give some thought to it. Because even the non-Buddhist practitioners of single-pointed concentration know that the suffering of change is something unwanted, even for them. And therefore, they cultivate the different levels of concentration and also the union of concentration and penetrative insight, which are which pertain to the worldly type of experiences still. But when the Buddha said there is no suffering, he refers to this pervasive suffering of existence, which is the psychophysical aggregates, which are the source of suffering, are the source of other types of suffering, and that they come through the contaminated causes. And so the text that we'll go through will cover these points about impermanence and suffering and so forth. Wherever you are in the three realms of existence, it is said that there is no true happiness, which means that it is referring to the pervasive existential suffering. And so this is the what the Buddha refers to, the existential pervasive suffering, when he said, no suffering. And so when you understand this, this is the nature of samsara, to suffer, and you'll not be disturbed, as with Geshe Podowa had said, that we have created the causes for the suffering that we undergo. And so there's nothing that we don't deserve as such in terms of suffering when we suffer. And so if you don't like suffering, what you need to do is to actually eliminate the causes that would give you more suffering in the future. And therefore, you see things from a broader perspective. When you come to see all the different problems in the world, you would be able to understand that this is what is the result, and this is the result of our own the causes that we have created. Sometimes people almost become unconscious, and even they go. Sometimes people go to the length of committing suicide when they find some suffering unbearable. But when you understand suffering from the point of view of this pervasive existential suffering, which is rooted in our karma and delusions, and then particularly ignorance, the fundamental ignorance, which is distorted about reality, thinking that conceiving that things have some independent absolute existence. And therefore, the Buddha said that the origin of suffering must be overcome. So karma, which impels us into samsara, which in turn, the karma comes through our negative emotions, the destructive emotions. And these two in turn are rooted in ignorance. And so due to the difference in the understanding of the reality, therefore, the different philosophical schools also have different understanding and explanation of negative emotions and the ignorance. So all these different philosophical schools, the purpose of them is to be able to identify the different degrees of negative emotions that we have, and how to actually create or cultivate the antidotes to them accordingly. Because if you cultivate or develop the antidote for antidote against the coarser negative emotions, they won't serve as antidote for antidote against the subtler negative emotions. And therefore, we should know that there are certain techniques which may be techniques or certain practices which may counter the negative emotions temporarily, and to reduce the strength of these negative emotions. For example, the meditation on love may counter our anger, hatred, to a certain degree, but it will not overcome hatred completely, and it will also not serve as an antidote to the fundamental ignorance as well. And therefore, we need to actually study these things, and then learn through our analysis and research, and then relate these teachings within ourselves. How when we are overcome with anger, how to counter them. And for example, one of my American scientist friends has said that, told me that when somebody becomes angry, totally angry at somebody, the person whom, or the thing that the person is angry at, seems absolutely negative. And he is somebody who has actually done research on people with psychiatric problems. So he's not a religious person, leave alone being a Buddhist, but this absolute negativeness in the other person whom you are angry at, 90% of it is merely your own mental projection. This is what the scientist says. And so, exactly what Master Nagarjuna says in the fundamental treatise of the Middle Way. That because of our misconceptions, inappropriate way of thinking about something, therefore we create the attachment, anger, and so forth. So it's very clear that our misconceptions can cause us distorted views, can cause us attachment, anger, and these negative emotions. And so in order to be able to identify what ignorance basically is, that basic ignorance, which is the root of samsara, well, the Buddha said, overcome this the origin of suffering. And so what we need to know is the nature of this ignorance or nature of the origin. And because it's an ignorance, and because the basic nature of mind itself is luminosity or clarity and awareness, and therefore ignorance is not in the intrinsic nature of the mind or consciousness as such, but it is adventitious. When you are able to establish the reality well, first by learning, studying, and hearing on the teachings, and then contemplating on it, and then developing the actual experience or insight into reality. And therefore, the Buddha said, you should actualize or develop cessation within oneself. And therefore, in order to reach that cessation, you should cultivate the path which comprised the three trainings, training of morality, the training of concentration, and training of wisdom. And so the three trainings are a huge summary, a good summary of the, sums up the entire practice leading to that cessation. And therefore, in Burma, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, and Sri Lanka, they follow the Theravada tradition. And then there is the Mahayana, followers of Mahayana. And to both these traditions, the teaching on the Four Noble Truths is shared teaching. And then we have the four attributes of the the Four Noble Truths, which make up 16 different attributes or characteristics of the Four Noble Truths. And on the basis of that, then there are the four foundations of mindfulness, and then the four exertions, five strengths and five faculties, and then the sevenfold path and the eightfold noble path, and so forth, which basically make up 37 aids to enlightenment. So all these are common to both the Theravada or these Pali and Sanskrit traditions. So when do we have the second session? So a break. So we'll have a break here. Let's say the praise to the 37 Nalanda masters. In English, it's on page 29. Tibetan page is page number one. So if you have the text, please open on page 29 of this book that has been distributed. Born from great compassion, aspiring to help all beings, God of gods, you have attained the Savior's state of abandonment and realization, and you guide beings through the discourse of dependent origination. O Able One, the Son of Speech, I bow my head to you. I bow at your feet, O Nagarjuna, most skilled in elucidating suchness free of elaborations, the essence of the Mother of Conquerors Sutras, through the reasoning of dependent origination, in accord with the Conqueror's prophecy, you initiated the middle way. I bow to your principal son, Bodhisattva Aryadeva, most learned and realized, who has crossed the ocean of Buddhist and non-Buddhist philosophies and is the crown jewel among those who uphold Nagarjuna's treatises. I bow to you, O Buddha Palita, who has reached the supreme adept state and who has clearly elucidated noble Nagarjuna's intent to find the meaning of dependent origination, the profound point of the existence as mere designation and as mere name. I bow to you, O Bhavivika, Master Bhavivika, most accomplished Pandita, you initiated the philosophical tradition wherein, while negating such extremes as the arising of truly existing things, one upholds commonly verified knowledge as well as external reality. I bow to you, O Chandrakirti, who disseminated all the paths of Sutra and Tantra, who are most skilled in teaching the profound and the vast aspects of the middle way, the union of appearance and emptiness, dispelling the two extremes by means of dependent origination, that is mere conditionality. I bow to you, O Bodhisattva Shantideva, most skilled in revealing to the assembly of most fortunate spiritual trainees the excellent path of compassion, that is most wondrous through lines of reasoning most profound and vast. I bow to you, O Master Abhichandarakshita, who initiated the tradition of non-dual middle way in accordance with trainees' mental dispositions. You are versed in the reasoning modes of both middle way and valid cognition, and you disseminated the conqueror's teaching in the land of snows, Tibet. I bow at your feet, O Kamaleshwara, who having explained excellently the stages of the meditation on the middle way view, free of elaborations and the union of tranquility and insight in cotton with Sutra and Tantra, flawlessly stated the conqueror's teaching in the land of snows. I bow to at your feet, O Asanga, you who, sustained by Maitreya, were versed in disseminating excellently all Mahayana scriptures and taught the vast path, and who, in accord with the conqueror's prophecy, initiated the tradition of mind only. I bow at your feet, O Master Vasubandhu, you who, while upholding the systems of seven Abhidhamma treatises as well as non-duality, clarified the tenets of Abhashaka, Sautantika, and mind only. Foremost among learned ones, you are renowned as the second omniscient one. I bow at your feet, O Dignaga, the logician, who, in order to present the Buddha's way through evidence-based reasoning, opened the hundredfold gateways of violet cognition and offered as gift to the world the eyes of critical intelligence. I bow at your feet, O Dharmakirti, you who understanding all the essential points of both Buddhist and non-Buddhist epistemologies, brought conviction in all the profound and vast paths of Sautantika and mind only. By means of reasoning, you were most versed in teaching the excellent Dharma. I bow at your feet, O Vimuktisena, you who lit the lamp that illuminates the meaning of the ornament to this, wherein the themes of perfection and wisdom stemming from Asanga and his brother were expounded in accord with middle way view, free of existence and non-existence. I bow to you, O Master Haribhadra, who were prophesied by the conqueror as expounder of the meaning of the mother of perfection of wisdom. You elucidated the excellent treatise on the perfection of wisdom, the three mothers, in perfect accord with the instructions of the Savior Mother, Maitreya. I bow at your feet, O Gunaprabha, most excellent in both integrity and scholarship, who having excellently distilled the intent of 100,000 disciplinary teachings, expounded the individual liberation vows flawlessly according to the tradition of Sarvastivada tradition. I bow at your feet, O Shakya Prabha, supreme upholder of discipline, who reigned over the treasury of jewels of the three trainings, in order to disseminate the strenuous discipline of teachings. For a long time, you excellently expounded the meaning of the vast discipline treatises. Oh, I bow to you, O Master Adisha, you who, having taught all the profound and vast traditions related to the words of the Buddha within the framework of the path of the The persons of three capacities were the most kind masters disseminating the Buddha's teaching in the land of snows. Having thus praised these most learned ornaments of the world, the excellent sources of wondrous and insightful teachings, may I, with a mind unwavering and pure, the blessed be blessed so that my mind becomes ripened and free by understanding the two truths, the way things are, exist. I will ascertain how, through the four truths, we enter and exit samsara. I will make firm the third and the three truths. Faith in the three jewels that is born of valid cognition, valid reason. May I be blessed so that the root of the liberating path is firmly established within me. May I be blessed to perfect the training in renunciation and aspiration for liberation, the total pacification of suffering and its origin, as well as in an uncontrived awakening mind that is rooted in an infinite compassion that wishes to protect all sentient beings. May I be blessed so that I may easily develop conviction on all the paths pertaining to the profound points of the perfection and Vajra vehicles by engaging in steady reflection and meditation on the meaning of the treatises of the great step trailblazers. May I, in life after life, obtain excellent embodiments that support the three trainings and make contributions for the teaching that equal the great trailblazers in upholding and disseminating the teaching of scripture and realization through engaging in the exposition and meditative practice. May the members of all spiritual communities spend their time in learning, reflection, and meditation through the proliferation of sublime masters who shun wrong livelihood. May the great face of the earth be beautified throughout time. So when we had the first tea, we didn't say any blessing, but now we just said. So right now we just said the blessing for the tea and the bread, because we have the bread with the tea. So the last verse of this praise, through their power may I traverse the paths of Sutra and Tantra and attain the conqueror's omniscience, characterized by spontaneous realization of the two purposes. May I work for the welfare of sentient beings as long as space remains. So I'll just start with the explanation. So all the religious traditions, regardless of which tradition you follow, all of them teach love, compassion, patience, or tolerance, forgiveness, self-discipline, and contentment. They have the same message with regard to these points. So I know many very good practitioners from the different traditions, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, and so forth. So, of course, the religious traditions differ in philosophical view. On the one hand, we have the theistic religions, which believe in a creator God, but the non-theistic Sankhya and school and Jainism and Buddhism are non-theistic traditions. So most of the religious traditions, apart from these three, follow theistic tradition. So their focus is keeping faith in the creator, and they do not bother much about philosophical ideas, complicated philosophies, whereas those non-theistic traditions, what we say believe in is that we are responsible for our own experiences, good or bad. If we create good karma, you will have happiness, whereas if we create negative karma, then we'll have suffering. And so by understanding how things work in this way, understanding the reality, then you would be creating the causes for liberation. So Solanus just wanted to see again Tenzin La. He is 92, and his your head becoming bigger and bigger. You are very tough. You have had a fulfilled life. And so there's the teaching of the law of causality in terms of dependence. Causality. Whereas Jainism does talk about causality, Jainism believes in Atman, an independent soul. And similarly, I think it is the case with the non-theistic Sankhya school. So by thinking about law of causality, the Sankhya philosophers and practitioners think that once they understand the primal factor from which everything arises, they say that Atma kind of dissolves into that primal factor, and that is liberation. So what Buddhism teaches is that it is in your hands whether you have suffering or happiness. You have to work for your happiness and overcome your suffering. And therefore, it relates to making mental transformation change within. And therefore, there is much to learn about the workings of the mind. So in the case of the theistic religions, they don't have to think much about how the mind works and all these elaborate explanations of mind consciousness. Whereas in our case, we have to think about what karma is, how the different thoughts, processes give rise to karma, and how to overcome those wrong thoughts and so forth. And therefore, the Indian spiritual traditions, which have the explanations of, about higher, developing single-pointed concentration and penetrative insight and so forth, have much explanation of mind. So, regarding Buddhism, even today in the 21st century, even in places where Buddhism didn't used to be traditional religion, it has found people have found interest in Buddhism, and it's increasing. For example, in the traditionally non-Buddhist countries, I make it very clear to people that I have not come to propagate Buddhism, but I urge people that it's important to keep to one's own religious traditions. But there's an increasing number of people taking interest in Buddhism in those parts of the world. So as I said, so in all the Buddhist countries, we are the follower of the same teacher. As I said, in relation to the explanation of the Four Noble Truths and the three trainings, the practice of three trainings. But I find that there is lack of, we still lack interaction amongst the ourselves as Buddhists. But we have begun to have interaction amongst the ourselves as Buddhists. But somehow Tibetan Buddhism has been called Lamaism, as if it's not an authentic teaching of the Buddha. And one reason why this is so is maybe because of the prevalence of tantric practice amongst Tibetans, which is sometimes there are lots of shared principles or practices with Hinduism as well, as Khun Lama Rinpoche used to tell me. So he told me that unless we are able to differentiate Buddhist Tantra from the Hinduism, Hindu Tantra, and there are on the basis of understanding that of selflessness, there are very many things which are very similar in both the traditions. And when I was in Chile at one time, the organizers have put on the walls the different tankas on the walls in my room in the hotel. So I wasn't sure whether those tankas were of Hindu or Buddhist deities. So, because we as Buddhists must not have two-pronged faith, I wasn't sure whether I should actually bow or pay my homage to these tankas or not. And these tankas, some of them actually depict these chakras, the six chakras and the three channels. And so these also are similar in both the Hindu and Buddhist traditions. So as followers of the same Buddha, one teacher, so it seems that we are lacking this more contact with each other, one another. So what we have common and practice is the Vinaya, the monastic code of discipline, which is very good in Thailand and Burma and so forth. So recently, many of you have seen a group of Thai monks who came here and they started a peace march from this place to Ladakh. So they seem to be having when they take meal, they seem to be taking meal just on one spot, sitting in one sitting. So we had a meeting and and discussions, and then we said prayers together, and then we had lunch together. So it seems. So their arms bowels are very big. And so they took their meal in the arms bowel, and they took their meal from there. So to have a big arms bowel like that was too much for me. And I didn't want to take some glass bowl, so I had a wooden bowl, which is used in the Gyudon Gyume Tantric Colleges also. And then I had discussions with them about the Vinaya, the monastic monk's vows, regarding the four defeats, the 13 remainders, and the and then the minor vows regarding how to wear the monk's robes and so forth. And so with regard to the how to wear the monk's robes, in our tradition there are 7 points mentioned, whereas in the Theravada tradition they have only 1 point. And then they, with regard to the secondary called secondary infractions, there are only 75 in the Theravada tradition. So with regard to wearing the lower robe, in our tradition, there are 7 points, whereas in the Theravada tradition, it makes only 1 point. It mentions only 1 point, which says, which is to say that the lower garment or the skirt should be worn properly. And so, with regard to these Vinaya practices, we have the same practice. And when this is understood, it really creates a good rapport within, I mean, between ourselves and respect to each other. And when it comes to practicing or cultivating the concentration and wisdom, of course, the Theravada tradition have the focus on the 37 aids are to enlightenment, such as the mindfulness, 4 foundations of mindfulness, and 4 exertions, and so forth. And then the Buddha turned the second wheel of Dharma in Gridhakuti, the vulture's peak. So as I said, when the Buddha became enlightened, he actually stayed away from teaching, reciting, saying that he has found this profound, peaceful teaching, which is like nectar. And then in the second turning of the wheel, what is emphasized and elaborated is the true cessation, what is its nature, and so how to attain it, and precisely, and what are the paths leading to this more elaborately. And perfection of wisdom teachings or sutras were taught in the Vulture Peak. It was not taught in public, but to a very few disciples who have pure vision. And so there are other beings like gods, Gandharvas, Asuras, and as it's mentioned in, and also non-humans. And then there were like beings like Avalokiteshvara and other deities. For example, in the Heart Sutra, actually gives this dialogue between Shariputra and Avalokiteshvara. And therefore, those who were in the retinue in this in the vulture, on the vulture peak, retinue of the Buddha, and they consist of these beings who are like gods and so forth. And therefore, the second turning of the wheel teachings that that are part of this turning of the wheel did not become a historical record or come into historical records. And so Bhavivika says that very clearly. And then Maitreya's Sutra Alamkara also actually argues for Mahayana, these teachings being the teaching of the Buddha. And also Bhavivika's Madhyamakarsidaya, the heart of the middle way, also argues for these teachings or Mahayana teachings being the teaching of the Buddha. So the difference, if you were to look at the difference between the Pali text and the Sanskrit tradition text, so the Four Noble Truths is something which is common, and the 16 attributes also of these Four Noble Truths are common. When it comes to explaining these 16 attributes, then the Pali tradition more or less resorts to scripture, whereas in the Sanskrit tradition, explains it through reason, especially if you look at Dhammakirti's Brahmanavartika, second chapter of it, you'll find how these attributes of these Four Noble Truths are actually proved through reasoning. So although the 16 attributes may be the same, the subject matter may be the same with regard to this, the Sanskrit tradition, texts in the Sanskrit tradition use reasonings to prove the points of impermanence and so forth. And then during the first turning of the wheel, the Buddha taught selflessness, saying all phenomena, everything is without any self. And in the second turning, this also is elaborated and explained more precisely. And then there's the third turning of the wheel, within which, according to the Sandhi Nimojana Sutra, and then there is also the other type of third turning of wheel, which is the Tathagata Garbha Sutra. So although in the second turning of the wheel, the Tathagata Garbha is taught, but it is more precisely and more explained in greater detail in the Tathagata Garbha Sutra, the essence of Tathagata. So, and then the explanation of the Tathagata Garbha is more precisely explained in the highest yoga tantra teachings. In order to ripen our mind for this highest yoga tantra practices, then the Buddha also taught the three lower tantras, Kriya Tantra, Charya Tantra, and Yoga Tantra. It's generally speaking, the tantric teachings are meant for very specific disciples, tailored for them. And according to the physiological structure of the particular person, the teachings emphasize or the focus on using the wind energies, channels, and drops, and so forth. Whereas the sutra teachings are general teachings of the, Buddhism, whereas tantra becomes very specific teachings for specific and disciples, and therefore the tantric cycle of tantric teachings, you find the transmission from one person to the next. There's this lineage that is followed. Of course, in the Sutrayana also, we have the masters passing their transmission or the teachings to their disciples, and therefore we have also the transmission of these teachings from one individual to the next. And therefore, Nyingguan Tsongrapa has mentioned that within the teaching of the Buddha, there are those which are called general structures of the Buddha, teaching of the Buddha, and then those which are tailored particularly, specifically for very specific disciples. And so the perfection of wisdom teachings have spread also to China, and through there to Korea, Japan, and Vietnam. The teachings of the perfection of wisdom sutras have spread. And then regarding Nagarjuna's texts, they are also in these countries. And then also the Maitreya's treatises seem to be there too, but seems I don't know if they have the various commentaries to, various commentaries to Nagarjuna's and Maitreya's texts, like the Tibetan translation, like the Tibetans have. So Buddhism, after Buddhism spread in Tibet, it also spread to Mongolia during the time of the Sakya reign, and then later during the third Dalai Lama's time. And because of this influence of Buddhism from Tibet, there have been great masters of Buddhism in Mongolia. Lhasa Rinpoche used to tell me, and had once told me, that when the 13th Dalai Lama went to China and Mongolia, Lhasa Rinpoche also accompanied him. And so he told me that in Mongolia, when they have big lamas as their guests, so they ask that the Mongolian masters ask them, the great the invitee, to sit for some debate. And so the 13th Dalai Lama seems to have some difficulty to face that challenge. And but there was a great scholar from Drepung Losa Ling accompanying him, and Lhasa Rinpoche told me that that great scholar must have been really helpful to the 13th Dalai Lama. So there were great masters like Tsobo Tayang and so forth. So Baldin Chud, Tayang and Baldin Chuji. So this Mongolian master Baldin Chuji has written an annotated text on the root verses of philosophical systems of India. And sometimes the people have criticized that he actually sometimes doesn't stick to what Jamyang Shepa has to say. So in Mongolia, Buddhism spread like it spread in Tibet, the length and breadth of Mongolia. But now, in Mongolia, Buddhism is being revived, and we have about 400 students from Mongolia in our monastic institution in South India. So they are reviving this tradition that we have. So, as we just said, the prayer to the praise to the 17 Nalanda masters. And we as Tibetans are the real students of the Nalanda masters. So in the past we used to have this prayer to the six ornaments and two supreme masters, sublime masters, whereas that prayer actually does not include masters like Buddha Palita, Bhava Viveka, Chandra Kirti, Shandeva, Vimukti Sena, and so forth. And so in our tradition, what we do, how we do go about with studying Dharma, the Buddhism and Buddhist philosophy, is first memorize the root text, and then listen to the explanation of them, these texts, word by word, and then also do rigorous analytical study of them through debate. And so in this way, we study the texts written by the 17 Nalanda masters, and therefore I thought it would be good to have a praise written in the honor of these 17 Nalanda masters. as I was requested also to write. And I usually tell Indians that you are our spiritual gurus. Whatever we have, the knowledge that we have come from you, and therefore you are our teachers, because the Dharma has come to us from India, whereas today the teachers have more or less indulging in the material development and have forgotten the old wisdom that they have. And therefore, the students have much better knowledge about the Buddhist, the ancient Indian thoughts. So there may be few scholars who are learned in the different philosophical school thoughts of Buddhism and so forth today in Indians, but it's very difficult to find. So the boy, so His Holiness has praised one boy or a girl who is right in the front row, that he could recite the 17 Ananda Master's praise by heart. So that's very good, but you should also be able eventually be able to study the text written by these masters, so that you could explain to others what this Nalanda tradition actually teaches with regard to the path, the basis, the path, and the result. What are the reasons that are used to explain the teaching of the Buddha? So that is important for you to study as well. So some Tibetan scholars have said, or say, I don't remember. So sometimes there's this term that is used for some scholars, calling them the fearless leader amongst the group. Unless we understand the teaching, we will just be following the Dharma on blind faith, which would actually... if you do that, then you could be led anywhere by anybody. Therefore, these Indian masters' treatises are very important to learn and to understand what Buddhism actually teaches. So, of course, with regard to the new translation school or Buddhism in Tibet, we have marvelous teachings like Gyasamaja Tantra, but in order to understand the general structure of Buddhism as such, this won't help much. Treatises written by the Indian masters are very helpful to gain profound understanding through reason and the general structure of Buddhism. So His Holiness asked one boy to take off the sleeves of his chupa, I think, because he may be feeling hot otherwise. And then, with regard to this teaching, it comes from the 16 drops of Kadam, which is a very special teaching that comes through the interaction between Adisha and Domtempa. So this is part of the further teachings of the Kadam tradition. I have received the reading transmission of this the Kadam compilation of the further teachings of Kadam tradition. So it is within that. So that in regarding this particular text transmission, I have and the text that I'm using is part of the initiation of the 16 drops of Kadam, which was composed by Yongzhi Yinshi Gelsen following Benjin Lobsang Chögyen's tradition. So I have received a reading transmission of this, the Kadam father teachings of the Kadam tradition from Ling Rinpoche in Tibet. And then, with the reading transmission of this particular text, I have received it from Tijan Rinpoche as part of the 16 drops of Kadam. So when I requested Tijan Rinpoche for this 16 drop initiation, he specially did a retreat in order to give me the initiation, and so I received it from the initiation, and I also did the retreat, the necessary retreat on the 16 drops of Kadam. So when we do this initiation of the 16 drops of Kadam, so this particular text is also read by during the initiation. So to begin with, after Jodisha came to Tibet and Lhasa and in Tuling in the western upper part of Tibet, he wrote the Lamp for the Path of Enlightenment for Drumdenpa with whom he had a very special karmic connection from the past lives. And so at Yerba Lhari, when Nakso Lotawa and Drumdenpa and also Ngoc Legwit Sherub from Sangpu, although he had his own monastic institution, he specially came to listen to teachings from Master Adisha and Drumdenpa. And he requested George Adisha to tell the story of the past lives of Drumdenpa. And then, as Adisha started telling this story, Drumdenpa tried to stop him, saying, "There's no point in recounting the stories of my stories, I who am a samsaric being." And so Drumdenpa seems to be somebody who is quite tough, and therefore full of integrity and tough and serious. And when Adisha started, was requested to give the monastic ordination by some people, and Adisha actually thought of giving it, I mean agreed to do so, but Drumdenpa stopped him from giving this ordination, monastic ordination, because Adisha was following the Mahasangika Vinaya tradition, which is which is more lenient compared to the Mulasarvastivada tradition that Tibetans already have. So Drumdenpa actually objected to this. And regarding the story of Drumdenpa, since Ngoc Legwe Sherub Ngoc requested Adisha to tell the story of Domtempa, and Domtempa tried to stop Adisha. Ngoc actually became quite serious and said, I have left everything, my institution and everything in Sangpo that I have and behind, and come here to listen to Adisha telling or recounting your past life stories. So I'm not requesting you, Domtempa. I am requesting George, Adisha, and so don't be an obstacle here. Don't obstruct Adisha from telling this your life, past life stories. And he took off his head and showed it to Domtempa, asking him, please look look at my head. And he pleaded not to be an obstruction to this recounting of the So since Ngoc was very old at that time, he showed his gray hair to Domtempa and asked him not to stop Jo Adisha from telling. And so, in their past life, Domtempa Adisha was Lama Tima Mepa, and Domtempa was his disciple. And so, the as it is recounted in the Kadampa father and disciples' teachings, there are many stories like that in those texts. So there were five people, including George Adisha and Ngoc and Gishikama and Domtempa. So since all of them were very highly realized beings, there was a kind of a miracle that happened at that point. And then the 16 drops of Kadampa initiation actually evolved from those interactions. And they had visions of different deities. And then Aryatara said this. So there are five remembrances. So the text that we are going to go through touches on these five points. Take refuge in the Lama. Visualize yourself as deity. So the 16 drops of Kadampa can be summarized into these five. And so you have taken refuge in the master, then there's a deity, there's a vision of the mantra, and cultivating bodhicitta, and the meditation on emptiness. So these five points. So that was what Tara mentioned, the five points. Tantric teaching has spread widely in Tibet, and especially the highest yoga Tantra. And most of the tantric teachings and practices have the visualization of what is called the tree of merit, or the assembly, merit-filled. So whatever practice you do it within the parameters of purifying negativities and accumulating merit. And then there is the, there comes the seven limb practice. And so in the merit field, you have the master. And therefore, you also do the practice of Guru Yoga, looking, seeing your mind and the mind of the deities and your Lama as inseparable. And so, with Bodhicitta as the foundation, imbued with Bodhicitta, you meditate on emptiness. And from within that meditation on emptiness, you dissolve into emptiness, and that mind that is focused on meditation on emptiness, transforms into yourself as deity, and therefore you meditate on the unborn nature of the mind. And then you visualize yourself arising into a deity and recite the mantras. So with these 5 points in your mind, the 16 drops say that you need to recite this text, the Tree of Faith, a self-exhortation. So I've, as I said earlier, I received the initiation of the 16 drops of Gautam from my tutor, Tijang Rinpoche, Devchi Tijang Rinpoche, and then I did the necessary retreat, confined meditation retreat on it, and then recited this, recited the mantras. And recently in South India, at the end of the Lamrim, the teachings on the stages of the path to enlightenment, I did the initiation of the 16 drops of Gautam. And at that time, since Domdenpa called this text a self-exhortation, I thought this for this teaching here also, I thought of going through this text. And therefore, I requested Geshe-la Thakpa, to have the text. Last year, we had the book on Buddhist study of mind and psychology. And I told you that the students that I did study that particular text by Ajahn Yongzhin. I have memorized that text as well, although I've forgotten much of it now. And that summary on the study of mind and mental factors is very good to understand about mind. Have you memorized that text that we distributed last year at this time of the year? Anybody who has memorized the text? None? Have you put the books somewhere in where you put satsas? So it's no use if you do that, after thinking that it's a holy book and touching on your head and then putting it away. So last year we touched on the mind and mental factors and so forth, and this time we are touching on a text which is for subduing our mind. So he's always reading through the text. Om. Oh, mantras of peaceful Dharmal deities, bless my body, speech and mind of this man. So Om is a very prevalent, I mean, a well-known mantra in Hinduism. And even in Tantra, I mean, Buddhist Tantra, Om is considered very important. These three syllables, Om, Ahum. So with regard to the stage of Buddhahood, which is a stage where you have a totally pure body, speech and mind, which must come from the body, speech and mind that we have now, which are impure. And in order to purify these three doors, the body, speech, and mind that we have now, we go through the practice of Deity Yoga, where we do practice on the profound and the clarity or luminosity. And therefore, the path also comprises the meaning of Om Ahum, and the basis at this point that the body, speech, and mind that we have are also represented by these three, and then the purification, the purified state of Buddha's body, speech, and mind are also represented by these three syllables. So the first two lines. So the man here refers to, the term man refers to Domtenpa himself. So he's recalling his own body, speech, and mind and his practices. In the exalted spiritual palace of Toshita is the embodiment of two accumulations. Lord Dipankara Shri Jana, you proclaim the joyful feast of Mayana teachings. You are renowned as Namgatima Mepa. Akasha Vimala's praise sit upon my head as a crown, jewel. So, Master Domtenpa considers Chogya Adisha as his main teacher. So, Adisha Adisha was a disciple of this master called Serlingpa. And both of them Master Domtenpa was their heart's disciple as well. And Adisha was a follower of the Madhyamaka philosophical tradition, whereas Lama Serlingpa, his master, Savarna Dvipa, was someone who followed the mind-only school. So since Master Adisha followed Vidya Kokila's tradition, which is the tradition of Madhyamaka philosophy, so Lama Serlingpa had said that to him, because he was Serlingpa himself was a mind-only school follower, he said that to Adisha that your philosophical view is not good. So when Adisha was told such a thing by Lama Serlingpa, because he was very devoted to Master Serlingpa, it actually confirmed Master Adisha's conviction in the Madhyamaka philosophy. So Domtenpa was blessed by by Adisha, mainly on the basis of the teachings on bodhicitta, this altruistic intention, and the Madhyamaka tradition. Your great mother or teacher is the perfection of wisdom. Mere reflection upon its meaning eradicates the constructing ulcer of dualistic self-grasping. Pray, let the perfection of wisdom ornament my throat. So since Adisha and also Domtenpa followed the Madhyamaka tradition, which does not assert any intrinsic existence, so with regard to the perfection of wisdom teachings, the explicit content is emptiness, whereas the implicit content of those teachings is the parts and grounds. the three, what are known as the three knowledges and so forth. And Maitreya explicated those implicit content or subject matter of the perfection of wisdom teachings, and the explicit meaning or the content of the perfection of wisdom teachings were explicated, I mean further explained by Master Nagarjuna, and with his through his fundamental treatise of the middle way called Wisdom, and so, and his followers. So as we said, the Heart Sutra, which says that all the Buddhas of the three times, depending or relying on the perfection of wisdom, became fully enlightened, perfectly fully enlightened. And so the Buddhas of the past, future, and present, who attain or will attain or are attaining, have attained the four Buddha bodies, have done so relying on the perfection of wisdom. Although the perfection of wisdom teachings teach the perfection of morality and patience and generosity and so forth, not only that, even the followers of the Shravaka and Pratyeka Buddha yanas or vehicles have the practice, these practices of generosity, morality, and so forth. And but because, so the term perfection of wisdom is applied when your understanding of emptiness is coupled with the method part of the practices, and particularly in bodhicitta, and they are called perfections. And with regard to the perfection here, it could be referred to the agent, which reach the perfection as agent, which is the which leads you to the resultant perfection, which is the Buddhahood, based on the understanding of the basis, emptiness. So the Heart Sutra, or the perfection of wisdom teachings that are in the other countries in languages, for example, in the Heart Sutra, because in Korea, Japan, Vietnam, and other countries where they follow the Heart Sutra, they spread through China, and because the Chinese translation does not have the term also or even, and in connection with the phrase where it says in the Heart Sutra, the five aggregates also are empty of inherent existence. It is not there in these other languages also, but in our Tibetan translation, this term also is there. And so, what this has, what the significance of this is as we said earlier, that there is the teaching of the selflessness of persons. So during the first turning of the wheel of the Dharma, the selflessness of person is taught. So not only that, in the second turning of the wheel of Dharma, the Buddha also taught the selflessness of phenomena, the psychophysical aggregates, which are the basis of a designation of a person. And so, this selflessness of person is also taught. So the term also includes, I mean, is an inclusive term which says not only the teaching on the selflessness of person is taught, but also the selflessness of phenomena is taught. So what is emptiness then? So what is the nature of emptiness? As an answer to this, then the Heart Sutra says, form is empty, emptiness is form, emptiness is not other than form, and form too is not other than emptiness. The fourfold emptiness, as it is called. So when you talk about emptiness, it cannot be explained without actually relating to what you are establishing emptiness on. So the object of which you talk about emptiness has to be taken into account. So if you, for example, form is, I mean, if you look at form and try to search for form in there, then you will not find anything, and therefore form is designated, and therefore it says form is emptiness. So the emptiness of form is established on the basis of that form. Because when you search for that form, you cannot find anything but the lack of or the absence of that intrinsic existence of the form. And therefore, since form has no self existence, objective existence, but because it comes through causes and conditions, therefore we can see. Whereas if form were to have any inherent existence, independent existence, then it never change. Because something that is inherent or that is independently existing cannot go through the process of change as such. It will not be dependent on other factors. And therefore, if form were not to be in the nature of emptiness, then it will not function as form and have other aspects of form. And therefore, it says form is emptiness is form. And so dependent origination in relation to the form. And so dependent origination and emptiness actually work for each other. Because things are dependently arisen, we can talk about emptiness. And because things are empty, what it implies is that they are dependent on other factors, and therefore the emptiness and the appearance actually complement each other. So emptiness does not mean nihilism, but it means that things have no absolute objective existence, and therefore form is empty and emptiness is form. And therefore, since emptiness and form, what is their nature or essence is said by these two other phrases, which says emptiness is not other than form, and form too is not other than emptiness. So the emptiness of form and form itself are not separate entities, independent or unrelated entities, but emptiness of form is a property of form itself, or a quality of the form. So the emptiness of form and form itself are essentially of the same essence or nature, although distinct in terms of our conceptual understanding. And so the Heart Sutra goes on to say that just as the form is there's no form and so forth. So we should understand those phrases where it says there's no form, no order, and so forth, meaning that there is no inherent or absolute or independent existence of form a sound and so forth. So otherwise, if you would take no form, no order, no sound and so forth, literally without understanding the meaning, the correct meaning, I mean, you would think that, oh, the Buddha is actually saying something nonsense perhaps. And that's not the case. My late elder brother, Dr. Rinpoche, told me there were two people from Amdo, two persons. One actually knew the Heart Sutra by heart, the other didn't. And so the former actually recited the Heart Sutra very loudly in front of the other one, who didn't know it by heart. And then after the recitation, the second person told the first person who recited the Heart Sutra, he said that you could have, I mean, instead of saying no eye, no ear, no nose, and so forth, you could have just simply said no head. Because of his annoyance, he actually told this to person. So when you come across these terms, no eye, no ear, no nose, and so forth, in Heart Sutra, you should understand it within the context of what I have explained and what comes earlier in the text, that they do not have inherent existence. So once you find conviction in the fact that things have no independent existence, but you also know that they actually affect you in your life, we have sights, visual consciousness, seeing the forms, and we have hearing consciousness, hearing the sounds and so forth. And so that shows that they are not non-existent, and therefore what the conclusion is that they are merely designated, independently designated. So the purpose of understanding this is, as I said earlier, and then also in this 400 verses, it says that once you have overcome ignorance, the rest of the negative emotions will be undone. And so, in order to overcome our negative emotions, we actually sees that there is no independent absolute existence in things, it will counter the grasping at some absolute existence in things. And therefore, you'll overcome ignorance. And so, this is the point that the Buddha makes when he says, overcome the origin of suffering. Otherwise, without any understanding, if you just focus your mind rather in some form of meditation, thinking that, oh, there's nothing to be established nor negated, and see the real as real and so forth, without real understanding of the emptiness, nothing will happen to you. And therefore, you need to develop the understanding of emptiness, and then you need to develop that understanding further and further. The experience develops further and further, and this is what is referred or shown by the Heart Sutra mantra, which says, Gate, Gate. So, Gate, Gate mantra says, go, go. The first two gathis refers to go, go, and then the third one refers to go perfectly, and go perfectly beyond, the fourth one says, and then bodhiswaha refers to establishing or the founding, the laying the foundation of enlightenment. So these five phrases or the in the mantra shows the fivefold path, which are part of accumulation, preparation, seeing, meditation, and normal learning. And so, in the process of developing this path, we develop the merit, purification of negativities, which mainly happens during the path of accumulation. And then the part of preparation is like a preparation to enter the path where you see emptiness directly. And then the part of seeing means you see emptiness directly. And the part of meditation refers to acquainting your mind further with this insight, direct insight into emptiness, within which, up to the eighth ground of bodhisattvas, you mainly overcome the negative emotions, and then after that, from the eighth to the tenth, you focus on overcoming the obscuration to knowledge. And so through this kind of process, then you lay the foundation of the enlightenment. And so what you reach at the end is the Buddhahood, which is the embodiment of the four Buddha bodies. And so first it shows the purpose of teaching emptiness, and then it explains the higher emptiness itself and how to go about with the meditation on emptiness and develop further and further. So the verses, starting with your great mother or teacher, and then the next verse, in these two verses, the Drumtempa is praying, saying that pray, let the perfect wisdom ornament or adorn my throat, and pray, let these adorn my heart. So by meditating on emptiness, which has the complete supreme aspect, as it's called, and by uniting the method and wisdom and the three trainings. And so, and also with regard to the scriptures, because there are within the scriptures those of the definitive and provisional teachings, you need to use and back need the support of reasoning to establish what is definitive. And all shine radiantly as the sun and the moon. Pray, let these ornament my heart. I'll stop here for today. It's 11:30 now. So since you have the book with you, please read it. And the explanation that I have given, just try to recall them. And this is called reflective meditation. And then you could also discuss amongst yourselves, friendly discussions, and try to clarify if you have not understood. Some of you have not understood, and some of you have understood. You can help each other to discuss and remind each other, one another, of what I have taught. And then the next days, since we say the Heart Sutra, if we could recite it by understanding the meaning, then it would be beneficial to overcome to shake the root of our deep grasping at true existence and things. And then you'll have some taste of what is meant by the Buddha when he said, Buddha's statement, that you should actualize cessation, or so that you could have some simulated sort of, or some experience. And then you'll have a real, true faith and true understanding, which comes through reason and understanding and the true cessation as well. May the jewel like Bodhicitta arise in those who have not had experienced it yet, and may it not decline but increase ever more in those who do not have it. There is the prayer to the prayer of the ecumenical prayer, I would say, in the text also, written by His Holiness. On page 64 for English, 64 in English. To all-knowing Shakyamuni, whose essence is the fourth Buddha's four bodies, Amitabha, Amitayus, and Supreme Arya, Avalokiteshvara, Manjushri, Vajrapani, the frowning Tara, the victor, and the host of courageous Buddha sons, the seven great successors, the six ornaments, the two supreme ones, the 80 Mahasiddhas, the 16 elders, and so forth, who think only of helping the doctrine and wandering beings, the supreme beings, and all the bodhisattvas, please listen, the supreme able one, during countless eons, through completing the two collections of merit and wisdom of merit, when beyond all knowing, compassionate ability, by the power of this truth, may the entire doctrine of the victorious victor flourish for a long time. The pioneers who first opened the door for the light of Dharma in the land of snow mountains, Chandrakshita, Padmasambhava, and Chasundetsan, the translators, Panditas, Vidyadharas, and 25 disciples, by the power of your previous pledges, may this victor's doctrine in the land of snow flourish for a long time. The extensive teachings, which are like a jewel house, storehouse, containing the great treasure of the profound practice, illuminated by the bright rays of the profound and extensive heart's essence, may this victor's doctrine in the land of snows flourish for a long time. Within the vast essence of clear light, primordial purity, the pinnacle of vehicles, totally encompassing all the phenomena of samsara nirvana, the means that lead to the city of Samantabhadra, may this victor's doctrine in the land of snow flourish for a long time. The lineage of profound view and vast practice, the treasure of complete teaching held by Adisha, the tradition of advice that comes through Dham Tempa, may this victor's doctrine in the land of snow flourish for a long time. The teaching of the Buddha collected in the three baskets, well arranged as advice into the path of the three beings in the golden rosary of the Kadam tradition, with its four deities and three texts, may this victor's doctrine in the land of snow flourish for a long time. The great translator Marpa, Shevadorje, Milarepa, and the rest, the jewel treasury of the Gaikyu, that source of inspiration, the unequal succession, that marvelous tradition of teachings, may the victor's doctrine of land in the land of snow flourish for a long time. All phenomena of samsara nirvana, reflection of the spontaneous mind, realizing the mind itself as the nature of the Dharmakaya body, Dharma body, free of elaboration system, Mahamudra, which pervades all appearances of samsara nirvana, may this victor's doctrine in the land of snow flourish for a long time. The scholars upholding the Dharma through explaining, debating, and comprising key points of the many texts of Sutra and Tantra, common and uncommon sciences, the godly Kuntan lineage, the great compassion Sakyapa, may this victor's doctrine in the land of snow flourish for a long time. The heart of the most profound practice of cross path and its fruit, possessing the four validities, the whispered lineage, the tradition of the teaching of attributes, tradition of teaching, the attributes of the powerful yogi, may this victor's doctrine in the land of snows flourish for a long time. The teaching of the victor is Lozang Dhakpa, skillfully spreading the profound view and clear appearance, the path of two stages, the great sixth Vajra vehicle closer related to the profound middle way, may this victor's doctrine in the land of snows flourish for a long time. The highest pure tradition, which practices the meaning of the three baskets and the four classes of Tantra, the complete path without mistaking its sequences and essentials, may this victor's doctrine of the land of snows flourish for a long time. The combined Buddha and Jodhpur,
Jonam traditions, which set forth renouncements of scriptures and insight of the internal and external alternate color chakra, a tradition of explanation unique amongst the sutras and tantras. May this victorious doctrine in the land of snow flourish for a long time. In short, the 10 great pillars of explanation, the chariots of practice lineage in general, and the 8 and the Shiji and so forth, rich with many quintessential instructions, combining sutra and tantra, made this victorious doctrine in the land to flourish for a long time. May the upholders of the doctrine live long and harmoniously. May the Sangha preserve the teachings through the 3 wheels. May beings having faith in the Dharma fill the earth. May the non-sectarian doctrine of the victor flourish for a long time. War, famine, malicious thoughts and deeds. May even their name become unknown throughout all worlds. May beings have loving kindness. Goodness increase within the environment and inhabitants, and an ocean of happiness and joy spread in all directions. Henceforth, may I too be solely striving, by solely striving in hearing, thinking, meditating on the complete path of doctrine, the profound view, the vast mind of Bodhisattva, quickly touch the ground of temporary and eternal happiness. For the sake of beings as infinite and space, may I engage joyfully with faith and aspiration, without laziness and discouragement and attachment to evil, in the delight for deeds of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, victor's sons. May all my body, possessions, virtue become the cause of bliss for all my mothers. May all my dear suffering and its causes of others totally ripen upon myself. May all who see, hear, remember, and have confidence in me be subject to great joy and happiness. And even those who slander, punish, and blame or disparage me, all have the fortune to enter the path of awakening. In short, as long as peace and Jesus, as long and sufferings, wandering beings, and exist with soul. May I too remain as the sole source of help and happiness directly and indirectly. And this next prayer is the prayer called Words of Truth by His Holiness.
And deeds of the negative forces of humans and non-humans who harbor malice through perverted prayers against the teaching of the Buddha be totally vanquished through the power of the truth of the 3 jewels.